Thank you, David, for that introduction. And as David said, this work I'm going to talk about is brand new. It will appear on the web tomorrow, at least the first paper on this topic, and then another detailed paper shortly after that. And also, as he emphasized, this is a very speculative subject. And so in a way, I think we've done these talks the wrong way around. I should have done the specialized talk first and be told by all the string theorists it's complete garbage, and then we could have canceled the colloquium. But instead, I'm going to give the colloquium first, and tomorrow I'm going to have to tell all the string theorists that they're just talking garbage to justify my talk today. But seriously, I have been interested for a very long time in trying to connect string theory to cosmology. I believe this is a very important and fundamental thing to do. I think cosmology doesn't really make sense without a connection to a theory of fundamental physics and quantum gravity in particular. And likewise, I think the theory of strings or quantum gravity doesn't really have any use unless it connects to cosmology. So I've always believed that very strongly. And in fact, when David hired me to go to Princeton to be an assistant professor, I thought in 87, 88, I thought, aha, I'm going to go to Princeton and study how string theory will work in cosmology. And it took me about half an hour, I think, at Princeton to realize this is not going to be easy, and the field just wasn't ready for it. Well, I'm going to describe a scenario in which some of the concepts of string theory are fundamental and play a role which turns our view of cosmology literally upside down in a very concrete way, in which the state of the present universe gets directly related to the beginning of the universe and the Big Bang. And this is a cyclic model in which the universe repeats itself. There's a Big Bang and a Big Crunch and a Big Bang and a Big Crunch. And this cyclic universe is quite interesting because it actually explains why there has to be positive vacuum energy in today's universe. Why it's one of the most puzzling observations of recent years has been that there seems to be a cosmological constant, and the cyclic model that plays a key role, and as you'll see. And basically, this model, because it ties together the beginning of the universe and the late universe, or the early and the late universe, I should say, there's no beginning because it's cyclic, it gives us a hope of explaining the parameters in today's universe, which pre-existing theories really didn't give one a hope, any hope in that respect. So let me just start by reviewing the state of cosmology today. It's a tremendously exciting field. We have lots of observations, lots of accurate data. Something like a standard model emerging in the last few years. So let me just summarize this standard model for you. And so all of these observations, the recent observations, have fitted together in a remarkably consistent way. And what they're telling us is that the universe is very simple in some respects, namely, its structure is simple. The universe appears to be flat on large scales, just like Euclidean space. It seems to be that the density fluctuations are scale invariant, meaning that the amplitude of the inhomogeneities in the density is the same on all scales that are observationally accessible. So observations are consistent with that. And finally, these fluctuations are what's called adiabatic. And in simple language, that means that the universe emerged from early times with deviations in the density, but the relative abundances of different particle species was fixed from place to place. So where you have more photons, you have more baryons and more dark matter. Where you have less photons, there are less baryons and less dark matter. And that's called adiabatic perturbations. That's the simplest type of perturbations. It tells you that microphysical laws determine the relative abundances of species, and then all that happens is a modulation of the net density. So all of the recent observations you have heard about regarding the microwave background have been consistent with this hypothesis, which is extremely simple, and in fact sort of so simple that it demands a simple explanation. But the universe is not so simple in its makeup. Okay, so what is the universe made of? Well, it seems to be dominated by a cosmological constant. Most of the density in the universe, about 70% of it, seems to be in some form of vacuum energy, something which has negative pressure and behaves just like a cosmological constant, and it's causing the universe to accelerate. And this is a real puzzle as to why this should be present now. And the big puzzle is, of course, why if it was present, if it had a larger magnitude, it would have dominated very early, because the cosmological constant is constant and its density doesn't decrease as the universe expands, whereas the density of everything else does decrease. And so the cosmological constant, the ratio of cosmological constant to everything else, is not independent of time. And if we live at a time now when the cosmological constant is 70% of the universe, then if we halve the age of the universe, the cosmological constant would go down in a bit. If we halve the size, then the matter would be 8 times greater, would go up by 8, because the density goes as 1 over 8 cubed, but lambda would be the same. If we double the time, the matter will become totally irrelevant, and the lambda completely dominant. So you have to live at a special time for lambda to be present in large amounts, but not completely dominate. And so that's a huge puzzle. We also have puzzles that the density of the dark matter, and this is omega is the fraction of the density in the universe in that particular form of matter. And there seems to be dark matter which is present also in substantial amounts. This is in 70%, this is about 25%. And then we have baryons, ordinary protons and neutrons, which are present at about 5% level. And then we have photons and neutrinos, and these are present at the 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 4 level. And in the standard cosmology, the fact that these numbers are comparable is not explained. Why should it be that there's the amount of dark matter is comparable to the number of baryons, or the number of photons, or to lambda? So these are all huge coincidences. Okay, so this is a fine-tuning problem to explain how it is that the initial conditions of the universe were tuned so that some lambda was present, but in such a tiny amount, just the right amount, that it came to dominate today. It's a terrific fine-tuning problem, and if you look at it from a sort of conventional point of view, this lambda is 10 to the minus 120 Planck masses to the fourth in the usual units, and that's the magnitude of fine-tuning, is that lambda has to be tuned to 120th decimal place, but still not be zero. So from this point of view, theory is not doing very well at all, though theory has had a lot of success in dealing with the first question. So I'm going to talk about a model which at least has a hope of addressing these problems, unlike pre-existing models. The other thing to say is that these coincidences are so severe that it's driven many people, including me in my foolish moments, to something called anthropic principle, which you may have heard of. And in fact, we had a whole conference devoted to this earlier this year. And all I'm going to say about that is the model I will talk about is, we hope, a way of avoiding the anthropic principle.
Why do you use plural coincidences?
No, these are all coincidences. Why is this comparable to that, and this comparable to that, and this comparable to that? There is no explanation for why.
If the cosmological constant goes away, you're still equally puzzled.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm asking.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no real explanation for why these should be comparable. Okay, in any model. I mean, in practice, you have theories of the origin of baryons, and you tune the baryon density, tune the parameters in those theories to get this coincidence right.
They're not continuing very comparable?
No, it's not so bad. I mean, you have to produce the baryons. The way of saying it is the number of baryons per photon is about 10 to the minus 10 in today's universe. And so you have to tune parameters to get this. But there isn't a fundamental explanation for that. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about theory. And as you no doubt are aware, there has been a dominant theory in cosmology, which is the theory of inflation. And this theory has really dominated the field for the last 20 years, and it's played a terrifically important role, because when you have a definite theory that makes predictions, it's tremendously stimulating, both to observers and phenomenologists. It ties everything together, gives you particular things to shoot at to try and disprove the theory. And the existence of this theory has been incredibly important. In fact, I think you can make a strong case that cosmology doesn't really make sense without a theory. We're never going to have enough data that we can determine what the universe is without a theory. And having a theoretical framework, even if it's wrong, is tremendously important, because it gives you a complete story, and then you can go after different aspects of that story. And you don't even have to believe the theory for it to be useful. Okay, the theory is tremendously useful in tying together bits of data and trying to make things make sense. And of course, you make progress if you prove the theory's wrong. So this really has driven the field, I would say, towards precision. I believe that the satellites which are now flying, the MAP satellite is mapping the whole sky, the Planck satellite will be flown in 5 years' time, I believe those satellites would not have been flown if this theory didn't exist, because they're really going after the predictions of that theory. So let me talk a little bit about inflation. So inflation, and let me apologize to those of you fully aware of this. Let me just give you a brief review of what inflation is. So inflation is the idea that there was some other matter in the universe, something called a scalar field, and the scalar field behaves just like the cosmological constant, in the sense that it drives acceleration of the universe. And so we describe space-time with a metric. And so let's just pick the simplest flat three-dimensional space. A is the scale factor, so it blows up the universe if it expands, if A increases, and T is the time. So that's the simplest flat Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. If we have a scalar field, then the equation of motion of the scale factor is the following. G is Newton's constant, so it obeys that equation. And a scalar field in an expanding universe obeys its own equation of motion. Okay, so V is a potential energy, and you can have any function you like, classically. And so this equation describes a particle, if you think of phi as the coordinate of a particle, describes the particle rolling downhill. And this equation describes how space expands or contracts in response to the energy and pressure in that particle. Turns out that the pressure is equal to phi dot squared minus V, and the density is equal to phi dot squared plus V, so it's a half here. And so potential energy for a scalar field actually contributes negative pressure. And then it's a peculiar feature of general relativity that negative pressure causes a repulsive gravitational field, which you can see from this equation, that if V is positive, so the pressure is negative, and if the kinetic energy is negligible, then this equation says that A double dot is proportional to A, and so A grows exponentially with time with a fixed Hubble constant. So this is the basic idea of inflation, is that there are solutions. If the potential is very gentle, so this field is only rolling down very slowly, then while it's rolling, the scale factor of the universe expands exponentially, and that expansion actually damps the motion of the field to make it roll even slower, and so you get into something called an overdamped regime. Or slow roll regime, where the scalar field is creeping down this potential very slowly and the size of the universe is blowing up exponentially. And the importance of this is that what it does, this exponential expansion, if you have any inhomogeneities in the universe, if the universe has any density inhomogeneities or curvature, or space curvature, then blowing up its size wipes out those inhomogeneities and makes the universe very, very flat and very homogeneous. And so at least you get to explain the first line there, universe is flat, and also the fact that the fluctuations in the universe are small. In fact, classically they're zero, but if you look at the quantum mechanics of this field rolling down the hill, it gets more interesting. And I think this is really what convinced people inflation was a good idea, was that not only could explain why the universe is so smooth, but it also produced the fluctuations. So let me just review that. I just look at this equation of motion, but expand the field. Here I've assumed it's homogeneous in space. Let's now expand it in modes around this background solution. So delta phi of t and x we'll write as a sum of Fourier modes e to the I k dot x. And you look at look at the fluctuations in phi. They obey an equation like this. And let's just ignore this term. If you compute the fluctuations here, then, for example, if the potential were linear in phi, this would be a constant, and there would be no quadratic term at all. And so we can ignore that. And so the fluctuations in phi, at least if the curvature of the potential is small, obey that equation, just those for a massless field in an expanding space-time. And that does something very dramatic. If you have a field which, in a space which is growing, that's stretching the modes of the field, and that automatically generates a scale-invariant spectrum of fluctuations in the field. And to see that, let me do a little bit of algebra. I change from t to tau, another coordinate called... Sorry? Yeah, these are all delta phi k. Okay, so if there was no expansion of the universe, every mode just oscillates, but this freezes in the oscillations. So now it's convenient to change from this time to another time called conformal time, because then the metric is just conformal to Minkowski space. Okay, so you've just pulled out the scale factor. In fact, there is a mistake in here. This should be over a squared, because those modes are really co-moving modes, and they're being stretched. And the purpose of this change of variables is just to get rid of that a squared, because there are two dt's in the denominator there. So if I do that, and then also I make a substitution, delta phi is chi k over a. Purpose of that substitution is that fields tend to redshift away. When a is increasing, the amplitude gets damped. And you can take that out to first order by doing this. And then you find that this new field, chi, is just a harmonic oscillator. And primes denote d by d tau here. So chi k is just 2 over tau squared minus k squared, chi k. Okay, so you just have that the field modes are harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent frequency. Now, when you look at the range of this variable tau, it turns out that that range, the simplest way to think about it, is that tau actually goes from minus infinity to zero, and the scale factor is blowing up. Roughly speaking, the scale factor goes like minus 1 over tau, blows up. Now, let's think about what this field does. And first of all, we've got to decide what the initial conditions are for this field. And so the usual assumption in inflation is that this field starts off in its ground state, that every one of these Fourier modes is a harmonic oscillator if at early times, large negative tau, this is irrelevant, and so they are just it's just a harmonic oscillator, and then we can work out the amplitude of chi by saying that the energy in each mode is just h bar times the frequency. Okay, so this is just half k x squared equals actually a quarter h bar omega. I'm not going to worry about numerical factors. And so this tells you that the amplitude of a mode of wave number k is h square root of h bar over k. Okay, so that's what the vacuum is for any field in the universe today, that the amplitude of Fourier mode k is 1 over k. Now, what does this equation mean? It means that at early times, the field is going to oscillate like that. But at a certain point in time, when this tau becomes sufficiently small that this term dominates, then you can forget the k squared term. And now you've got to solve this differential equation. Chi double prime is 2 over tau squared chi. And it's easy to see that that has a growing mode solution, which is just 1 over tau. See, if I differentiate this twice, I get minus 1 over tau squared, then I get plus 2 over tau cubed, which is the same as the right-hand side. So basically, this mode oscillates, okay, and then at a time equal to 1 over k, it blows up as 1 over tau. So to find the solution for the amplitude, we should take this oscillatory solution, which has this amplitude, and then multiply it by 1 over k tau, because the time at which it starts blowing up is 1 over k, and this is the amplitude it blows up by. Now, what's so good about this? The point is that that's proportional to 1 over k to the 3 halves. And so now if I calculate the variance in chi, that's a sum over all the Fourier modes. I've got to square the amplitude, and that's scale invariant. Okay? Scale invariant means equal power in each logarithmic interval of k. So that's how scale invariance emerges in inflation. And essentially for this reason, this inflating field, as it's rolling downhill, acquires this very long wavelength spectrum of fluctuations with equal power on each logarithmic range of wave number. And that's very beautiful because it means that when you blow up this universe, expand it exponentially, what you've done is convert ordinary vacuum fluctuations into large-scale perturbations with scale invariant spectrum. That's exactly what you need to explain the data. So this spectrum was postulated for phenomenological reasons long before inflation, and it was believed a really compelling success when inflation predicted that spectrum. I should say it's somewhat adjustable that in order to get this 2 here, I had to take exactly that exponential behavior. Of course, the field is going down the hill, so h is decreasing with time, and you can fiddle a bit, and in general, you don't get perfect scale invariance. In fact, it's very adjustable. But the generic result is approximate scale invariance. So that's been a very successful theory, and many of the recent observations have been interpreted as confirming inflation. But there are a lot of problems with this theory, okay? One of which is you have to explain why the field started uphill. I mean, you just started there by hand in order to get lots of inflation. And so there's a whole question about why it started up the hill. There's the question of what the field is. We don't know what this field is. It's just introduced ad hoc. And in fact, it's proven very difficult to get inflating fields out of fundamental theory, like supergravity or M theory or string theory, generally do not have fields with this form of potential. And there are even theorems that say that, at least at a classical level, it is impossible to get an exponentially expanding universe like this out of supergravity with certain assumptions built in, like compactifying on a smooth manifold. The other problem with this is it really decouples the early from the late universe. Okay, I do all this in the early universe, it goes away, there is no observational constraint on this field from today. It's rolled down the hill, it converts into radiation, and then disappears. And so there's no coupling of this field to anything relevant today, which is quite good in terms of being impossible to disprove, but it's but it's sort of it's also displeasing. So now let me talk a little bit about this alternative model, and as David mentions, I will give you a technical talk about it tomorrow. So now I'm just going to talk about the ideas. And this arose from an idea which emerged from M theory called brain worlds. So let me just talk a little bit about brain worlds. What was found is that supergravity had a lot of trouble providing a realistic spectrum of particles. You take supergravity literally, 11-dimensional supergravity, and insist on space-time being a smooth manifold, then, for example, it's impossible to get chiral fermions, as is seen in nature. And also, connection to string theory was not clear. But Harava and Witten proposed a resolution of both these difficulties, which is that actually there are vacua for 11-dimensional supergravity which are not smooth manifolds. And these vacua look like the following. You have brains, and if I draw this one as a plus brain, and another one, I'll tell you why I'm drawing it like this in a moment, as a minus brain. Okay, I hope that's clear. I can get rid of that line. So basically, these are two infinite flat parallel sheets. There's a positive tension brain and a negative tension brain. And if you allow this setup, then I should say that it looks very disturbing at first, that there's a sort of end of the world here. But the prescription is a certain type of boundary condition that I just declare that the space on the right of the brain is a perfect image of the space on the left. And so, for example, if I've got some function doing this in the y coordinate, here's the plus and here's the minus, then that function has to be reflected, and an image of the minus has to appear over there, and then you again identify these two ends. So it's just a method of identification which does provide exactly the right number of boundary conditions on all the fields so that the evolution, dynamical evolution of this system is completely well defined. And this type of boundary condition is called an orbifold boundary condition. So here's the setup, that Harabar and Witten told us that the world really isn't just a four-dimensional manifold, it's two four-dimensional manifolds, that six of the dimensions in 11D supergravity are curled up and small. One of them is this orbifold. This is the 11th dimension, and conventionally taken. And the other four are these flat Minkowski sheets. Now, our work in this topic was inspired by a lot of developments in this field, but particularly by the fact that this model really seems to come straight out of supergravity. Okay, it's very interesting that it's a sort of perfectly legitimate supergravity background. And so that's what intrigued us about it. And the reason we started working on this was an extremely naive idea, okay, and I think to some extent it's still a completely extremely naive idea, but it hasn't failed yet. And the naive idea is that when you've got a setup like this, there is nothing which prevents these two boundary brains from coming together and colliding. There is no force in the theory. In fact, the theory, these are BPS states, which means they're completely degenerate in energy, and this distance can be arbitrary at the classical level. And there is nothing that stops these things coming to meet. And you can have them coming to meet in an arbitrarily slow velocity, and at least according to the classical theory, it's allowed. So our idea was simply that what happens if these two brains smash into each other? It's bound to be a non-adiabatic process. There are all sorts of modes whose masses depend on this distance, and these modes will be excited, you'll generate radiation, and this sounds very much like the hot Big Bang. Okay, so it was as crude as that. Just the idea that this brain collisions could have started the Big Bang. But we didn't publish anything on this for 2 years. And the reason is that we tried to do detailed calculations of this. And one really wanted, you know, something other than just saying you start the Big Bang. Okay, something definitely useful for cosmology. And what we realized is that within the context of this theory, There is another way of getting scale invariant fluctuations. Okay, and let me explain the other way. So it came from this brain world setup, but you can describe it purely in terms of a scalar field. Turns out the distance between the brains, of course, is a four-dimensional coordinate scalar, and so you can represent this theory as four-dimensional gravity coupled to a scalar field. Now, we were interested in these brains being pulled together by some attractive force so that they hit at some finite velocity, and that would convert into radiation. So we started playing with potentials for that scalar field. And we were interested in potentials which were attractive and which allowed the field, the brains, to sit there for a long time far apart. Okay, so our initial idea was that they sit for a long time, for some unknown reason, they start off. I'll tell you the reason later. But let's imagine we just have these two flat parallel brains attracted by a very weak force, and then they come and collide. So we'll just postulate a potential like that. And on physical grounds, I don't think this is unreasonable. It's saying that such a potential, for example, would be generated by exchange of massive particles. If you really... If you have an exchange of massive particles, then just like the Yukawa force falls off exponentially with distance, you would get a potential which fell off exponentially. And so it might look something like that. I should emphasize, we actually have struggled to try and get a phenomenologically correct potential out of supergravity. We have not succeeded yet. Okay, we've got things with the qualitatively right form, but not quantitatively. And that, to be honest, I feel is probably the last thing that will fit into place. Just like with inflation, there's been 20 years of work on that without really a good fundamental theory giving you a potential. We haven't got that yet either. But that's why we started thinking about potentials like this. Now, what does that do? Well, if I describe the fluctuations of this scalar field, then initially, you see, if I put it on the plateau, and I say this plateau at zero energy, then the scale factor of the universe is not going to respond to that energy at all. It's another equation, which is that A dot over A squared is 8 pi g over 3, 1 half phi dot squared plus v. If this energy is zero, so we have flat parallel brains, no energy, the universe is not going to be expanding or contracting. And so we should just think about the scalar field in Minkowski space. And we realize something quite remarkable, which is that a field falling off a potential like this in Minkowski space makes a scale invariant spectrum. Okay, so let me just show you that. So the equation I need is this. Okay, so let's just take that equation. That's a second order, that's a fluctuation equation for this equation with the spatial terms. And let me take as a concrete example a potential which is negative exponential. Okay, the result is generic, but providing the potential goes very, very flat. In other words, more precisely, has a strong negative curvature and asymptotically approaches a constant, then you get scale invariant fluctuations. Why? Well, if you look at the background solution, it's phi double dot is minus dv d phi. And you can see that there is a solution of this equation where phi is minus 2 over c log of minus t. So the field is falling off the hill. Let's take time negative again. And time 0 will be when the field's gone off to minus infinity. If I use this solution, then you see if I put that phi in there, then, that's a plus. If I put this in there, then the c's cancel, the 2 comes in multiplies the t, so I get 1 over t squared. So v is proportional to 1 over t squared, and the left-hand side is also proportional to 1 over t squared. So that's just a scaling solution of this equation, which you get for exponential potentials. Now, if we go and work this out, then, see, putting this in there, I will see that v is minus 2 over c squared t squared, and d2v d phi squared is just c squared v, so v comma phi phi is 2 over t squared, and so you see what you have here is just plus 2 over t squared, and now you notice it's the same equation that we had up there. So for potentials that are very, and as I said, this is true exactly for an exponential potential, but in fact it's generic, that any potential which is asymptotically flat, if I set my field up in a state like this in Minkowski vacuum, let it fall off the hill, it makes scalar invariant fluctuations. And the explanation is exactly the same as it was before. These field at large negative t, I'm up here, the potential is irrelevant, and the field is oscillating. And then as t gets big enough to, or small enough to compete with that term, kt is 1, then the field blows up as 1 over t, and we get scale invariant fluctuations. So that was quite exciting. It's just an alternative way. Yeah. No, I'm saying that if I start off in the Minkowski vacuum, so I say delta. Yeah. With small corrections. It's exact for an exponential, but. There is a condition. You can show, for example, that if you take a polynomial, there's a general condition, which is something like v double prime. I forget the precise equation, so I can show, they're in our paper. For example, if you take minus 1 over phi to the n, then you get a spectrum which is k to the minus 3 scale invariant plus some function of n, which decreases as n goes to infinity. You can, actually, you can get either sign of correction, depending on the function. I don't know. It's in our. Yeah. The crucial thing is that 2. If it's 2, you get scale invariant for the reason I explained up here, that because of that 2, chi is 1 over tau is a solution.
Right.
So if you get 2, then that's the right.
But you're saying you can't put in any number there and find a potential that only produces any number?
You probably can. You probably can. But for all potentials that are asymptotically flat and have strong negative curvature, you get scalar invariance. The general analysis is in our paper. I just can't remember it. Okay, so that was simply proposed as an alternative, but to inflation, that's another way of making scalar invariant. But we got into something much more interesting out of this. And the reason is, also quite simple to see, is if I have a negative potential, right, and I wanted Minkowski space with this field rolling downhill, then this equation up here actually tells you V is negative, okay? And so this term is positive, so the universe must contract. So we can make a scale invariant spectrum of fluctuations, but only in a contracting universe. Now that sounds bad, okay? And we said in our paper that this is a problem, and how do we deal with it? But we go back to this picture of the brains, okay? And basically what happens is it's a very interesting map between the brain system and the scalar field and phi. It turns out that the scale factor on this brain, and this is simplifying things a little bit, but the scale factor on this brain, let's label this brain zero, the positive tension brain, that turns out to be a cosh phi, and the scale factor on this brain is a sinh phi, where phi is the scalar field. And so when you look at the dynamics of these brains, then the action is the following. The action for the brains is minus a naught dot squared plus a one dot squared. This is in the conformal time units. And what it means is that the motion of these two brains is just described as the motion of a free particle, but a relativistic particle in this space of scale factors on the brains. Okay, and in fact, it's quite complex because at zero separation in the brains, this scalar field, in fact, goes off to minus infinity. And this scale factor here, I should put a minus sign in there, scale, phi goes to minus infinity, and A goes to zero. So in fact, a collision between the outer brains, you can also write it this way, A squared is A naught squared minus A1 squared. When those two brains meet in this embedding space, the scale factor of the universe in conventional Einstein frame scale factor is zero. And so the issue about what happens when these two brains meet is in fact the same issue as what happens at a big crunch, singularity. Okay? And that sounds terrible. Sounds like when the two outer brains meet, there's a big crunch. But again, if you plot this in A0 and A1, then it turns out that to get any, the only brain configurations there are, which are static, have to have the scale factor, this one, bigger than that one, and they have to exist on this side of the plane. And it turns out that the dynamics of the trajectory you're following in field space at the big crunch actually looks like this. A naught, it's a massless particle, so it's null, and it comes and hits this point called the boundary of moduli space. And what happens next? So here, physical intuition comes into the game. And my intuition is that these two big brains, when they hit each other, simply go through. There's nothing to stop it. And these are huge objects. And so the picture is, if I look at it from the side, here is plus and here is minus. They coincide. So the extra dimension has shrunk to a point, and they just go right through. Okay? So that's just a guess. But we have done lots of calculations to check that guess. And remarkably, so far, there's no inconsistency. Okay? And tomorrow I'll explain some of the details of that calculation. But since the title of this talk was a cyclic universe, I just want to show you how that works. See, the basic point here is very simple. It's that what appears to be singular in the four-dimensional effective theory is just an artifact of the change of variables from the 5D theory. That when these brains hit, the four-dimensional scale factor is in the five-dimensional metric is in fact finite. The only singularity involved here, it's not a curvature singularity, it's not a density singularity, because the brains have finite scale factors. Matter coupled to the brain sees no zero in the scale factor. So curvatures and densities are finite. What has happened is that one dimension has shrunk to zero for an instant. And in fact, in Kaluza-Klein terms, if the Kaluza-Klein extra dimension is a circle, then you have a space-time like that in the extra dimension where one dimension shrinks to zero and re-expands. So for one moment of time, the theory's gone from being 11-dimensional to being 10-dimensional. And does that make sense? And so we've done some calculations. Joe Polchinski, I know, has been thinking about this with Natty Seiberg. And there are certainly some calculations which are positive evidence for this, in that if you regulate this singularity like that, by just artificially putting in, making it an hourglass rather than a cone, the answers for many quantities that you calculate turn out to be independent of that parameter. You can take it to zero. The other thing to say is that the deviations from 4D gravity are only significant in a region, in a very small region here. And since we don't believe 4D gravity anyway, we know that breaks down because we think there will be string corrections. String corrections would be enough to let you go through, assuming they worked out correctly. They would be big enough in magnitude to let you do that. You can do something even more interesting, which is to solve the density perturbations of the universe, okay, in the system. So this is an important check. If I've got some perturbations in a conventional cosmology, and I evolve them to T, to a big crunch, then you expect them to blow up. Okay, in fact, density perturbations in matter grow super exponentially. I mean, when you're in a contracting phase, they grow, if the universe is static, they grow exponentially. When you're contracting, they diverge faster than exponential. So as soon as you did a density perturbation calculation, you would expect a disaster. Well, we've done the density perturbation calculation, and the amazing thing is that for matter, which is dominated by a massless scalar field, that's all we've got here. We've got gravity from a 4D point of view. We've got gravity and a massless scalar field. Massless scalar field has an equation of state P equals rho. It's what's known as very, very stiff. The speed of sound is 1. And for such an equation of state, it turns out that the density perturbations are finite at T equals 0 in a big crunch. That the when you're dominated by massless scalar field, you try and evolve the density perturbations, delta rho over rho, and this is quite a technical business, so you can look at our paper for all the details, but basically the equation you find for the long wavelength modes of the density perturbations looks like that. There's the singularity at T equals zero. So your differential equation is singular. However, the general solution of this differential equation is that. That's perfectly regular. So you have to actually check that, and in fact, this equation guarantees that epsilon is finite at the singularity. So one can evolve these perturbations all the way through to the singularity and match as you go through. There are various matching prescriptions you can adopt. And what we hope is that, so for example, you can make it into an hourglass, or you can chop the tips of the cone off and replace it by a cylinder, okay, and many other ways of regulating it. What you hope is that the quantities you're most interested in are independent of that regularization. If they are, then at least they have some hope of being correct. Ultimately, you hope that string theory will regularize this in some way. Now, that's, as I say, that's just a hope, but I think without that hope, you see, this may sound very radical. It is very radical. We're going through singularities. It's extremely radical, okay? However, the alternative is actually more radical. The only alternative is that when such a singularity happens, it's the end of time. And that's surely a lot worse. Okay. So what I would say is we're being conservative here. And anyone who doesn't like this has to propose an alternative. All right, now I haven't told you about the cyclic universe, so let me tell you now how that is. Oops. Which one is it? Is it the last one? The black one. So obviously, if you go through a crunch and you come out in a big bang, the next question arises, can you do it many times? Okay, can we have big crunch, big bang, big crunch, big bang? And if you can, then you can get a universe that lasts forever. You don't need time to begin. You don't need a theory of initial conditions of the universe. The universe lasts forever. And so let me just briefly explain how you can have that. So this is the recent paper with Paul Steinhardt called A Cyclic Universe. And I'm going to explain it in these Einstein frame terms, gravity plus a scalar field, just because that's the language we're used to. You should really think about it in terms of this A0 and A1, which are finite at the brain collision. But just for familiarity, I'll present it first in this language. What does it mean? So we come out, as I said, when the brain's touch fires minus infinity. Then there are arguments from string theory and M theory that, at least if this is the 11th dimension, that non-perturbative effects have to vanish. And presumably that's what this potential is, though, as I said, we can't really calculate it from first principles. But we just assume this potential vanishes as you go to minus infinity. Now, let's imagine, and then as we go to positive phi, we're going to want to match the observed vacuum energy of the universe, the cosmological constant. And as I said, we'll actually explain why there is a cosmological constant in this model. We won't explain its magnitude, but we'll explain why it's there. Let's imagine we start here. So we're in today's universe, we're expanding, and dominated by a cosmological constant. Now, we want to get to a big crunch. How do we do that? We have a potential that slopes gradually downwards, like this negative exponential I wrote down. Okay, so it's constant minus negative exponential. So it will drift gradually down here until it gets to there. As it's expanding, energy is redshifting away all the time. When you hit this point, the energy is zero. It's not actually at the zero of the potential, it's a bit below, but the energy hits zero when kinetic plus potential is zero. At that point, the Hubble constant vanishes and the universe turns around. Now the universe starts contracting, and as it's contracting, the scalar field's falling off the hill, making density perturbations. Okay, so now we make our scalar invariant spectrum of density perturbations. But the universe is contracting, and so this field phi, its energy is blue shifting. It's gaining energy all the time from the contraction. So it runs over this hill and zooms off to minus infinity. And that corresponds to the two brains hitting. Then, as I said, they pass through each other. And what that means is phi comes shooting back in from minus infinity. And there are matching conditions you have to calculate here. And one way of doing it is to impose energy and momentum conservation on the brain collision. And that I'll explain tomorrow. But when you do that, it turns out you get a completely sensible answer. You define the energy of the initial state and demand that energy and total momentum are conserved. And you impose what's called the Israel matching conditions, which define the relation to the bulk geometry. You get a sensible answer that tells you what the rate is at which phi comes in from minus infinity. Now the scalar field comes shooting in from infinity, overshoots this potential well, gets stuck on the potential, and the whole thing starts again. And so if I do look at these variables A0 and A1, which you should think of as... Yeah, we have to adjust that height to 10 to the minus 120. But the problem, okay, so we have not explained that number. We certainly haven't explained that number. What we have explained is that there has to be a positive lambda. Otherwise, it turns out this is not an attractor. When you look at this as a dynamical system, then the existence of that lambda, what will it do? It wipes out density perturbations, cleans it, can't keep going. Otherwise it keeps going. Yes, for example, if it was zero. That's right. It would just keep going. No, it's not. It would not repeat. So it would not be cyclic. So it would not be cyclic. So if you traced it backwards in time, you would...
I'm just trying to think about it.
Right.
You're trying to explain, you said you're trying to explain why lambda is not zero.
Right. Lambda not being zero.
But I thought it was kind of the other way around.
No, the answer is...
If lambda is not zero, it's cyclic, I believe it.
Right.
But, you know, since there's no principle that it's cyclic,
so you could say that there might be some, yeah, I agree. I mean, there could be some solution where the brains come in from infinite distance, collide, go apart, go off to infinity, yeah, and it would not repeat forever. So it's only if you want it to repeat forever that that you need a lambda. So this principle of saying that there should be a cyclic solution and it should be an attractor requires the presence of a lambda.
Where is all the entropy?
So this is the ancient objection to cyclic universes. Tolman thought about these in the 30s, but he thought about them in the context of a closed universe without a lambda. Okay, and his argument was that at every bounce you would have to make entropy. And therefore, at each bounce, you'd have more and more and more radiation, so the maximum size of the universe would have to get bigger and bigger and bigger. The converse is, if you trace it back in time, it had to come from zero size in a finite time. And that means you haven't solved the problem of the beginning of time. You trace it back, you've got a few bounces, but it still converges in a finite time. In our context, we've got flat brains with a lambda. And if you think about things in terms of the brain metric, this is all that happens. Okay, so every bounce, the brains move apart, they then accelerate, come in for the next bounce, and come out again, accelerating, and that can continue forever. And the point is that in a flat universe, the scale A doesn't actually mean anything. If I tell you this, that A in the universe is 10 or 1,000 or a million, it doesn't matter. What matters is relative scales. And all that happens in this flat universe is that you make radiation with some fixed physical density when they collide. Then the brains expand it away, okay, so you get down to zero density again. Then they come in and collide, and then they expand it away again. So you have infinite brains, which in the brain metric, I just expand exponentially, basically all the time. Okay, there's little variations.
So it's like each cycle, the portion of the universe we see is
yes.
Different.
Yes.
There's a lot of entropy out there.
Absolutely.
So the and everything else.
Yeah.
Because we have the next question.
Black holes.
Black holes.
They all got diluted. So the reason for lambda existing is to dilute everything away. And so it's a question, the quantitative question, how much lambda do you need in order to have an attractor? If you make it big enough to dilute all the baryons to one per Hubble radius, then you almost certainly do have an attractor, but that's probably overkill. All you really need to do is make sure that whatever perturbations you develop in one cycle are erased sufficiently that the net perturbation decays from cycle to cycle, and then you'll have an attractor. So so that's the model. I think I ought to end there. I also should say that, in fact, we last week we realized that this model, when you think about it in terms of the brain metric, is if you coarse-grained it over large times, so look at many of these cycles, this model is, in fact, Fred Hoyle's steady-state model. and the scalar field phi is what he called the C field, okay? Because what's going on is that the brain collision, the scalar field phi is a function of time. And that means it provides a slicing of the background space. And the background space is basically De Sitter space because it's dominated by the lambda that's present, you know, at late times. So essentially, these brains are De Sitter space, but with a few wrinkles on it correspond to each big crunch. And so if you take De Sitter space, slice it with the scalar field, okay, And then the scalar field is what's responsible for making matter. I mean, the brain collisions are where the scalar field makes matter. It only happens once in a while, but it certainly defines a slicing, and that's exactly what Hoyle wanted. So it's not something I ever set out to do, but this model actually provides a new implementation of the steady state universe. Okay, thanks.
We have time for questions.
You started by saying new theory is falsifiable. Can you give us an example of something you predict?
Yes.
Comment on steady state. Disprove it.
Yes. So this is only steady state when coarse-grained over trillions of years. Okay, so we're not disproved by that. But here's a specific prediction. The inflation, as I told you, amplifies any quantum field, and any massless quantum field will obey the equation I wrote down, will get a scale invariant spectrum. In particular, gravitons will. So one of the real signatures of inflation is that there ought to be a long wavelength spectrum of gravity waves. Inflation generically predicts gravity waves with long wavelengths, scale invariant spectrum. You can adjust the amplitude of those gravity waves. You can make it arbitrarily small. But if you stick to simple polynomial potentials like phi squared or phi to the fourth, the amplitude's big enough to be observed. And in fact, at the M-theory meeting in Cambridge, which Joe was at, after my talk, Stephen Hawking challenged me to a public bet. And he said, I bet you that gravity waves will be discovered at a level greater than 5% of what was seen by COBE. So on the larger scales, gravity waves should contribute more than 5% of the temperature fluctuations. And our theory doesn't predict any gravity waves. Okay, so because, as I explained, the whole mechanism is completely nothing to do with gravity. Things are in flat space, falling off a potential hill, and the metric is just sitting in its vacuum the whole time. And so the clear prediction is that there shouldn't be any gravity waves. So far they haven't been detected, and the upper limit now is about 30%. Okay, the gravity waves are known to be less than 30%. There's some caveats there because it's somewhat model dependent. But this is something which could be detected. And people have proposed a satellite to look for the signal of gravity waves. And the one clear signal there is that the polarization of the sky should have a curl if you have gravity waves. Basically a scalar, if all you have is scalar perturbations, then every time you look for a vector or a tensor, it's just composed of gradients of that scalar. And so if I calculate, for example, the integral of a dot dl around a loop, I should always get zero. And it's a little bit complicated with tensors, but there's the same sort of idea. So basically, if I measure the polarization of the sky and I integrate it against a window function like that, then I have to get exactly zero if it's scalar. Okay? And so you now convolve the sky instead of ordinary spherical harmonics with these kind of magnetic harmonics, and you get a non-zero signal if they're gravity waves. This was not pointed out by us, I should say. It was pointed out by Kamienkowski, Kosowski, Penn, and Seljak a few years ago. But we've done a recent analysis of it, and it turns out that this is the tensor amplitude. That's what phi squared inflation gives, 4 times 10 to the minus 10. Any monomial, phi squared, phi to the fourth, whatever, gives bigger than that. Okay, so that's the minimum for simple inflation potentials, power law potentials, and these are the limits of which would be gotten by a satellite a few times more sensitive than Planck. So this looks like it's achievable. You can estimate 4 grounds than Planck. So this will require a dedicated polarization satellite. And there are proposals now to build such a thing. And this is certainly very exciting if it were seen. And so far there doesn't seem to be any strong reason why this won't work. Though I should emphasize that inflation theory is extremely adjustable, okay? And one way of saying it is it's basically a theory without any principles, okay? And so you can just have this theory V of phi adjusted arbitrarily and get what you want. You can almost get anything you want from inflation. And so you can just lower this below the experiments if you want to, but I think at that point the theory gets a lot less interesting because it's just escaping from the observations. So that's the critical test.
I don't understand why there aren't gravity waves in Earth. You've got a potential. That potential just sitting there generates gravity.
Oh, are you worried about the late potential? It's minuscule because it's today's cosmological constant. So the amplitude of the gravity waves is square root of 10 to the minus 60.
It's coming out of the cross.
Potential is zero. It's kinetic dominated. Yeah. So the we do have inflationary fluctuations in our model, but they're generated by today's cosmological constant, and the magnitude is 10 to the minus 60, and so those are negligible.
Did you say how long we have till the next crunch?
Unfortunately, it's a free parameter, but basically, it depends on how many e-foldings of inflation you have. And so if you say we only need, I don't know, we have 100 e-foldings in order to wipe out all the density and perturbations and black holes and entropy, if we have that, then you'll have about 100 Hubble times, 100 of today's Hubble times. So it just relates like that. You can ask yourself, how much do I want to dilute the universe? And that determines how long we'll last till the next big crunch. So what we advocate is 100, and then we will last, 100 times the age of the universe, which is a trillion years. And it turns out that this contraction phase here basically lasts one Hubble time. So you generate scale invariant perturbations for one Hubble time on the contracting phase. And you can ask, where did the scale of our perturbations come from in all this? They were generated about a millisecond before the big crunch, quite a long time scale in sort of Planck units before the big crunch. So if nothing else, I mean, this model turns everything completely on its head. And I haven't really explained it, but it turns out that this motion of the field depends on the matter density, the radiation density, the dark matter density. Everything couples to this field. This field also has violations of the equivalence principle built in, because essentially, you see, if you couple not to the Einstein frame metric, but to the Einstein frame metric times a function of phi, then that inevitably means there's a fifth force. And this field builds in a fifth force. That's the strongest constraint on this model, is you have to arrange that the coupling of matter to this field be a very flat function. And there's a dimensionless number which has to be less than 10 to the minus 3 in there to make sure it's... Sorry? Yes, that number comes... The strongest limit on these couplings, and by the way, these couplings are completely generic to string theory and M theory, and so this is probably the biggest phenomenological problem. Any model like this where you do not give phi a mass, if you gave phi a mass, you wouldn't have to worry about it. But if you leave phi a dynamical variable, then you always get couplings like this, where this beta is basically the coupling so that the metric that the matter sees is equal to beta times the Einstein frame metric. And this beta for us was very important because it resolves the singularities. This one is finite at zero scale factor, that one is not. And so, but this beta here, you have to make adjust the theory so that this beta has less than 10 to the minus 3 today. Okay, and where the 10 to the minus 3 comes from is that is equivalence principle violation. Measurements, the fractional deviation in acceleration between bodies of different composition is now known to be less than about 10 to the minus 12. And this turns out to be beta squared times 10 to the minus 5, right? Something like that. And if step works, then this will go down to 10 to the minus 18. And so you'll get a limit on beta, which will go down to 10 to the minus 6. So step is very important for that, in that respect.
From your point of view,
yeah.
What is your lower limit?
The lower limit. We don't care about beta. You see, the beta, all we want, yeah, all we need is that if I go to here, if I look at the scale factors, this turns out, sorry, so the scale factor of the matrices turns out to, well, it's beta times the scale factor, let's call this beta squared. Beta times the scale factor in the Einstein frame. And then the key thing is that in these brain world models, when the extra dimension shrinks to zero, that beta is a universal function. It doesn't, and it's exactly equal to e to the minus phi over root 6 in Planck units, a. So basically, as a goes to zero, this goes to minus infinity. This is finite. So what we need of beta as a function of phi to resolve singularities, beta has to blow up like this at negative phi. But then when we get to the values of phi, which are important today, beta has to be flat. Okay. And so for example, I mean, a very simple model is brains in ADS. That's the simplest model, and actually it's the only one anyone has completely analyzed. For brains in ADS, beta is equal to sinh phi. Sorry, beta is cosh phi for matter on the positive tension brain. And this is flat as phi goes to zero. Turns out phi equals zero is when the brains are infinitely far apart. So it does go flat, and you must just arrange that today's value of phi is sufficiently near zero that this coupling is small. So you can get around it, but it doesn't appear to us as severe a constraint as it appears to string theory people, just because the numerical value of it is not that tiny. But one also should say there is no brain world model really that coming from string theory for which this has been calculated and shown to be sufficiently small. I think, for example, in Hrabowitz theory, it's too large. Okay.
I'm here again. Okay.